Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
With us today is, she has to be the foremost expert on this crime. She's a lawyer, she's a retired judge, and she is the author of this fabulous book, Suspect Number One, The Man Who Got Away. Judge Lisa Perlman is here today. Hi, Judge Perlman, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming and devoting some time here. I just want to give a little bit of fact background to you because you have such a fascinating background, and I'm just enamored here. The Honorable Judge Perlman was in the first class of undergraduates at Yale University to include women, a first. After she graduated from University of California at Berkeley, she clerked for the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. She taught at Stanford Law. She became a partner in a prominent firm. And then she became a judge herself and was selected to be the first presiding judge of the state, first female presiding judge of the state bar court. And now she is a best-selling author of many books, and she speaks on these issues and on these books that she has written. Judge Perlman, you are, I'm going to ask you first, how did you become interested in this story?
I was writing a book comparing famous trials of the 20th century. And the chapter that I had on the Lindbergh case was the only one that seems still unsolved.
But it was solved in that someone paid the ultimate price and was executed for it, and we're going to get to that in due time. So let's just review for our young listeners or for our listeners who don't know much about history, who was Charles Lindbergh, and what can you tell us about him and his wife and his reputation at the time?
Charles Lindbergh was a pilot, and he was the first to fly nonstop from New York to Paris in May of 1927, which was a huge deal because it had ramifications not only for travel for commercial use, but also for war. And so the U.S. government made him kind of their poster child for creating the Pentagon eventually, for having airports, for getting ready for planes that might come from afar and bomb other countries.
And I think it's hard to imagine the kind of hero status that he had. And as I played before you came on, Judge Perlman, you know, there were songs written about him. There were artwork dedicated to him. I mean, he was, at the time, you know, one of the most brave people that we knew, right?
The Landy Hop.
Yes,
it's a
Lindy
Hop.
There was a dance.
Dance parade.
Exactly. Okay, so, and tell us just a little bit about his wife, Anne Morrow, because she was an accomplished person as well.
She was. He met Anne Morrow because of her father, who was ambassador to Mexico, who invited Lindbergh to fly nonstop from Washington, D.C. to Mexico City in order to improve international relations with the Mexican government. And they were married. She was a Smith graduate. She was an excellent writer. She wrote several books, and he trained her to be a pilot. She was originally his navigator.
Yeah, I've read a couple of her books. She's a beautiful writer, very, very accomplished. Okay, so let's flash back 94 years approximately to March 1st, approximately 1932. Let's take what Lindbergh's account was of what happened that night.
Do you want me to describe it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, please. Coming from him, because we're going to end up, I want to hear what you think really happened, because you've got a totally different story here.
I have a different story. Well, he contacted the police on the night of March 1 after his nanny and his wife reported his son missing from his crib. The 20-month-old was not there at 10 p.m. when the nanny went to check on him. Nobody was allowed to check on him from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. by house rules that Lindbergh imposed. So the police came, and Lindbergh pointed to a window in the second-story nursery and said that an intruder must have come in and that there was an envelope on the windowsill that they had left unopened for the police to open, and inside of it, the police found a demand for $50,000 ransom for this child. Outside, the police were led by Lindbergh to find a ladder in the yard. And they assumed that someone had come to the estate and tried to get in the window. There were a couple of them, actually, who thought it might have been instead an inside job, but they were quickly removed from the case.
And one little side note is that Lindbergh kind of had a mean-spirited sense of humor, didn't he? And he liked to play practical jokes and, in fact, had played a practical joke on the family relating to his son. What was that?
Well, when his son was 8 months old, he also had disappeared from his crib. This was at the Morrow Estate, where the Lindberghs lived most of the time. The home in New Jersey was just a weekend home at that point. And everybody frantically looked for him, and the assumption was that he had been kidnapped. Kidnapping in the 1930s during the Depression was very common. And for half an hour, they searched frantically until they found the little boy in a closet where Lindbergh had hidden him.
Interesting. So, I mean, the idea of him doing that joke again, does that even make sense to you?
Well, with Lindbergh's personality, yes, I think that's what he wound up doing. That's my theory, but it wasn't a joke. That was the first thing his wife and nanny accused him of. When the baby was missing from his crib, they went downstairs and said, "You know, did you take him?"
So that was their no. That was their first instinct. Lise Pearlman, she is the author of the award-winning book Suspect Number One, The Man Who Got Away, available on Amazon. And I will tell you that it is impeccably researched, it's beautifully written, and it's page-turning. Very, very entertaining, I would say. Take this long February, March, last of the winter, and get this book and read it. It's just fascinating. Thank you again for joining us. Let's talk about Bruno Hauptmann. We talked about the crime from the standpoint of the family. And who's Bruno Hauptmann? And tell us how he was accused of this crime.
Well, actually, he went by Richard Hauptmann. His first name was one he didn't use when he came to the United States. But the police liked it because it sounded more sinister. So that's how people remember him.
I didn't know that.
He was a carpenter by trade. He lived in the Bronx with his wife and young son. And he was arrested 2.5 years after the murder had taken place because he spent one of the recorded bills that was used to pay the ransom in April 1932, a ransom that didn't result in the child coming back home. What he said to the police and insisted on ever since was that he had been given a shoebox by a friend and business associate named Isidore Fisch in December of 1933 when Fisch went back to Germany. And he didn't open it, but Fisch told him it had important papers in it for him that he wanted to keep and come back and retrieve. Fisch died in Germany that spring. And in the summer of 1934, August, there was a big rainstorm. The kitchen closet where that box had been was drenched because of a leak in the roof. And Hauptmann said he took the box down and opened it up and found money in it that he didn't know was there. And one of the things about that money was that most of it was gold certificates, which was the prior currency that FDR outlawed in May of 1933. So it was no longer in circulation. So when he spent a $10 gold certificate to get gas for his car, it was turned into the bank. The bank checked and found it was on the list of bills that were used for the Lindbergh ransom, and that was how he got arrested.
So
when the police came, they searched his garage and found that he had a little over $14,000 of the ransom money of the $50,000 hidden in his garage. He said that he did that because he knew it was now illegal and that Fisch owed him some money and he was going to take what was owed to him and then return the rest of it to the Fisch family, which didn't happen because of his arrest. That was what he told the police. They called it his Fisch story.
And is there any idea that this Fisch individual did anything wrong? What do you know about him? And could he have been a culprit, or could he have just been somebody who just got in the wrong place at the wrong time?
He was implicated, and I have a discussion of that in my book. This was a known fraudster. He had bilked a number of people in his circle in the Bronx in the past. And he there were several people in Hopewell, where the Lindbergh estate was, who were interviewed and shown a picture of Isidore Fiske. And they thought they recognized him as someone who had been in the area just before the kidnapping, about three of them there. And also Lindbergh's own lawyer said that the picture of Fiske that was in the newspapers just after Hauptmann's arrest looked like the man who'd come to his office and seemed to be associated with the kidnapping for ransom back in March of 1932. That he hadn't told the police about until September of 1934.
So
yes, there were oh, another thing, a major thing, is that Fiske, there was a shipping clerk who said that Fiske used $2,000 of gold certificates to buy his passage back to Germany in November of 33, and those were that traced back to the, I think they could have been traced back to the ransom.
So let's talk about the latter, because that is something that is crucial to a lot of people's analysis of this crime. The latter that was propped up outside of the house in New Jersey, where supposedly someone went up and abducted the child through a window. Tell us about the latter and the significance of that in the prosecution of Hauptmann.
Well, it was a handmade ladder, and it was pretty flimsy and rickety. It was not propped up against the house when the police arrived. Lindbergh took the police to a place about 75 feet from the house in the dark and showed them, the police had a flashlight, showed them a three-piece ladder on the ground there, and two pieces were together and one was separate. That's what the police the next day propped up against the house to test the idea that that might have been used to kidnap the child. Turned out that all three pieces together were too tall. If that had been up propped against the house, the shutter couldn't have opened fully in order to bring the kid out the window. So they then assumed that it was two sections that had been propped up. And Lindbergh also showed them in the mud below the nursery that there were two holes that matched the feet of the ladder. But one of the original investigators said that the holes were too shallow to have borne any significant weight. The other thing the police found was that there was no indication that anything had fallen in the mud there. And the theory was that the child died because while he was being transported out the window, the child fell and cracked his skull open, had fractured his skull. There was no evidence to support that, no physical evidence.
Now, you don't believe Hauptmann was the perpetrator, and I'm just going to be a little bit of a spoiler here, and I think your theory is going to be that Charles Lindbergh himself had something to do with this kidnapping. Let's talk about, and this is just unbelievable. Instead of being a suspect, and as we know in the Guthrie case and any case that we see, every murder case and kidnapping case, the authorities look first at the family, the immediate family, the extended family, to see if there's somebody who might have had a motivation of some type. Now, why you would kill a 20-month-old child that's your own is bizarre, but tell us what the police did when it came to Lindbergh and putting him kind of in charge of this whole thing.
Well, first, they were told by Scotland Yard exactly what you just said, that the parents are often should be investigated because they are often the key suspects when a child's kidnapped from home, particularly a child who is abnormal. Charles Lindbergh Jr. was abnormal. He had an oversized head. He had a rickety condition. He had toes that overlapped. He had his teeth coming in late. There were different, and he had a fontanelle that hadn't closed, which should have closed on his skull by then. So he was an abnormal child, as diagnosed by his pediatrician. The New Jersey police ignored the recommendation and put Lindbergh in charge of the investigation. And shortly after they did that, key evidence began to be disappear or be ruined.
So they put the father in charge of the investigation, and he sat a table at trial. He sat a counsel table. Is that true?
He sat with the prosecutor, and on the first day, apparently, he had a gun holstered under his suit jacket. That was remarked on by a couple of the reporters, the idea being that if the jury didn't do its job, then maybe he would use it.
Plus, I would imagine the jury was enamored that Charles Lindbergh, the hero, was sitting at the good guy's table, right, and prosecuting the bad guy, who was the German immigrant.
Absolutely, because Hauptmann was had come to the United States as a stowaway 10 years earlier, and he had been a young soldier in World War I on the opposite side. So there were lots of reasons the public considered him public enemy number one, as the newspapers were then describing him.
Let's talk. I want to save it to the next after the news to talk about how they found the little boy's body, because it gets a little graphic. So just a word of alert: if some of these things upset you, you might want to walk away for a minute. But it's really crucial to the story, and it's something that I, someone who've read a lot about these things, I did not know these things. But let's talk about the lawyer who represented. Who represented Hauptmann. Tell us about the kind of representation he got in this case.
Well, there were actually a total of four lawyers on Hauptmann's side. The key lawyer, the lead lawyer, Riley, was the only one who had a lot of experience with death penalty cases in New York. But he was on a downhill trajectory. He was an alcoholic. Syphilitic, and he was a big hero worshiper of Charles Lindbergh. So he was overheard telling an FBI agent that he hoped that Hauptmann got the chair. He was not the best person to have on his team, but the guy who sat second chair, C. Lloyd Fisher, did believe in Hauptmann's innocence and did his best to help Hauptmann, and he wound up handling the appeal. The one thing that really got to me originally when I started researching this was looking at the evidence of the police record of the number of visits that Riley made to Hauptmann when he was in jail awaiting a death penalty trial. He came in as the lead lawyer, paid for by the Hearst newspapers, who are and Hearst himself was a big fan of Lindbergh. The idea was that he would give them daily exclusives, so he was very keyed to that more than his client.
That would be an ethical violation today.
Absolutely. Today it would be an ethical violation, but the police recorded all of his visits and their length. He visited Hauptmann four times from October through the beginning of the trial in January for an average of 10 minutes each time. When he left, every time Hauptmann was in tears.
And it probably they probably weren't tears of joy. He was getting railroaded,
no.
And he was watching the train coming right down the track. And this is the part that gets really interesting, and this is the part that I did not know. So, Judge Perlman, you went back and you did some research about this young child. He was 20 months old. You talked a little bit about, in your first part of your interview, about this child had some abnormalities. And would these abnormalities, first of all, you posit that the abnormalities could have been birth defects that were related to Ann Morrow's travel and airplane travel. Can you give us a little bit of detail on that?
Well, the press speculated that when Lindbergh took his wife on a trip when she was 7 months pregnant from Los Angeles to New York to set a record for speed, they noticed that she got very ill, probably from inhaling toxic smoke and also a lack of sufficient oxygen. When the plane landed, she was spirited away quickly, they thought to a hospital, and then she was put to bed rest at her home for the last 2 months of the pregnancy. And because there were so few pictures that the family released, there was a speculation that the child was abnormal.
And so they kind of kept that quiet because, you know, maybe back then it was not the same as it is here. And he was a very, very prominent person. And so let's talk about these impairments that you know about. Given your knowledge and your research into the medical condition of this child, would this child have lived a normal life, or could there have been some cognitive impairments down the line and some other problems down the line?
Well, I don't know if there would have been cognitive impairments. There's speculation by many that he was hydrocephalic, and if he was, then the shunt that is now used to drain that fluid hadn't been invented yet. That wouldn't be until the late 40s. So a child would likely die before adulthood if they were hydrocephalic. He was definitely megalocephalic. He had an oversized head. He might have had another possibility that my daughter came up with is dwarfism. My daughter, Jamie Benvenuti, was my chief researcher, and she's looked into that, and there's some other abnormalities. It looks possible that he had splayed hands, which would be consistent with achondroplasia, which is a condition that he would have been born with. If that's what he had. We can't really tell at this stage because of the lack of evidence. One of the things that happened was that Lindbergh ordered the cremation of his son immediately after a partial autopsy. They were expecting to do a full autopsy, and that didn't happen because of the cremation.
Okay,
that interfered with it.
Yes.
But the other...
Go ahead.
The child also had overlapping toes, and that was one thing that Lindbergh was able to point to, and the nanny was to recognize the child. This is 10 weeks after the child disappeared that the body was found in the woods. It was mostly skeletal, except for the head and the right foot. It was missing the right arm, the right hand and left hand, and one forearm, and also the left leg below the knee. And it was wearing two T-shirts, which the nanny identified as ones she'd put on him when he went to bed that night on March 1, 1932. She and Lindbergh identified the child. His pediatrician couldn't do so. Pediatrician came and looked at it, and he said, he's got an oversized head, just like my patient. He's got the teeth coming in the same way, the 16 teeth that my patient had, but you'd have to pay me $10 million, and I still couldn't identify him because of his advanced state of decomposition.
So let's go ahead to the end story here. And this, we're going to have a very little time before the break. But who is Dr. Correll, and could you briefly tell us who he was, what he stood for, and how he was associated with Lindbergh?
Well, Dr. Alexis Correll was French-born, came to the United States, and became the chief surgical researcher for the Rockefeller Institute in New York, and he did a lot of vivisections, both animal and human.
Tell me what that word means, just because it's not a word that we use very often.
Vivisection. It's operations on living bodies.
Okay.
Most of which wind up dead when you're through.
Got it.
It's opposed to analyzing something by an autopsy to try to find out information. He was very keen on seeing living organs interact. What he was trying to do was to experiment to create the opportunity for heart bypass operations and also organ transplants, because those were not available then in the 30s. Lindbergh went to him in 1930 because he was told that maybe Dr. Correll could help him find a cure or the opportunity for a bypass operation for his sister-in-law, Anne's older sister, who had a defective heart valve. And so that's why they got together. And then what happened was Correll realized that Lindbergh was a mechanical genius. And Lindbergh said, I can help you, because what you are doing is you're using a pump to hold excised organs and tissue, and your pump is becoming necrotic. It's making the necrotic environment. It's making the tissue die within a few days, so it's not that helpful. And that's what Dr. Correll had told him, and he said, I can improve on that.
We have just a few minutes, but I want to cut to the essence of this story. So, Judge Perlman, we have Lindbergh, who is interested in eugenics. We have Dr. Correll, who is interested in not only eugenics, but in transplants. The state of the body of this child when it was found later in the woods, what about it was suspect that made it look like he may not have, it may not have happened due to deterioration or animals, that it was taken somewhere else and that something else happened to the body?
Well, there were no reported bite marks or scratch marks on, and he was wearing two T-shirts. But if you, once they took the T-shirts off, they found that the in the chest cavity it was missing almost all the organs. It only had a partial heart and a partial liver, and everything else was missing, including the kidneys. I consulted a modern pathologist, Dr. Peter Speth, and he wrote a declaration about it. That the kidneys are the last to deteriorate. They should have still been there. The other thing that's impossible from his perspective and from my perspective is that the T-shirts would still be worn, still be intact, have no blood stains on them, and somehow animals were to blame for it. Also, the there was a lab, the Squibb lab, that was consulted by the police that same day, and they scooped up all the dirt and leaves all around the corpse and sent it to this lab, and the lab came back saying, we found no blood anywhere. And the police had found no blood on the site of where the child supposedly died at the Lindbergh estate. So that doesn't happen. That means, what it means is that the child died elsewhere. The other thing that was noted was by Dr. Charles Mitchell, who was the medical examiner at the morgue. He concluded that the child died at least 2 days later someplace else, that he could not have had the fractures caused to his head by falling from a two-story window into mud.
So,
and that was the theory, that was the theory on which Houtman was tried and convicted, and that the idea was that the body was deposited that same night of March 1 in the woods, but somehow overlooked in all the searches that were done. Well, that didn't make any sense to Dr. Speth either. The body appeared to have been placed there just shortly before it was found.
Okay, so let's put two and two together and maybe get five or six. You are very close to this. You researched it incredibly. And you, what makes sense to you, Dr. Perlman, Judge Perlman, if you were a betting person and you were going to come up with a conclusion of what happened here, what would that be?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to my daughter, Jamie, who did a lot of the research, especially about the Squibb lab report. It indicated there was detritus found there by the corpse, and it was consistent with a medical lab, including a pair of gloves that looked like they were someone had worn them in surgery. They had pinholes in a couple of the fingers, and there was a cloth there that was the size and description of the one that Correll used in his lab for some of his vivisection experiments, with a cutout for the operation on a carotid artery, which is described in a book that Correll's assistant put out in 1938. It seems to me, with all the evidence that we've uncovered, that there's no question in my mind that the child died at an operating table, and it was days later.
And the purpose would be what? What happened?
Correll did other operations on children. Those, as far as we can tell, certainly on humans, because he bragged about it. We found a letter. We saw reference to a letter where he was being offered some feeble-minded prospects for his work. The reason for doing it, but from Lindbergh's perspective, was if a carotid artery segment could be obtained from a compatible human and a blood relative like his son, that might have been transplanted potentially in an experiment to save his sister-in-law's life, because you would transplant that outside the heart, that the blood would flow through that transplant rather than through the valve, and then there would be time to operate on the valve and correct her problem. That operation never did occur. I think she was probably too weak for that. She died in December of 34. That was his purpose. That's why he came to Correll in the first place. Correll also was very interested in doing kidney experiments and doing other experiments with that matched up to organs that were also missing from this child.
So this makes him out to be, Lindbergh, to be a cold-hearted eugenic child killer rather than a heroic aviator and family man. Since this happened and later in the years, we've learned that he basically, I think he had a new family. He was living sort of a double life. He was living, there was a family in Germany. That doesn't make him a killer, but he was also very aligned with the Nazis, was he not?
Yes, he was invited to the 1936 Olympics to sit in Hitler's suite.
And so the bottom line is we still could probably get some DNA testing done. I know that there is a New Jersey State Police Museum. I spoke to them. I was trying to get some information from them before this interview. And apparently they have lots of documents, 250,000 pieces of evidence. They've got the electric chair there, I believe, that Hoffman was executed in. But also different handwriting samples and different things that were taken from the crime scene. Do you think, as you sit here, that there are things that could be tested still? Again, whether the integrity is still there, whether they've been too contaminated, but do you think that should be done and can be done?
Yes, it should be done, but the police are resisting that. Right now there's a lawsuit pending on appeal trying to get the testing of the, the envelopes were licked. The stamps were licked. They still have those from the ransom demands, so they could test those. They could also do testing on the wood, because wood DNA testing has been used for at least, I think, 15 years now, is much more accurate than the visual comparison that was done at Hauptmann's trial in 1935, which is no longer considered a valid way of trying to prove that one piece of wood came from the same original board as another piece of wood, which is what they were trying to do, because there was they thought he had taken one of the rails of the ladder from his attic, his landlord's attic, Hauptmann, to make the ladder, when actually the police had sole possession of Hauptmann's apartment for 3 weeks after his arrest and could have done that themselves.
And this is an age-old question, and I get this all the time, why is it that we are not testing DNA? And this is not even a recent case where there would be embarrassment, say, in the prosecution's office, and you want to stick by your conviction because it's going to look bad for you next election if you are cynical in that way. But this happened, 94 years ago, and the times were different, and things were handled inappropriately. I think we can all agree, even if you think that Hauptmann did it. So what is the reticence of just not giving this stuff up? Do they feel like it's going to damage their specimens, or what is it?
Well, in 1989, the head of the New Jersey State Police was interviewed on television, and he said, if new techniques come along, we want to do the testing. And that is no longer the view of that office. For some reason, they resist. Now, 2021 was the 100th anniversary of the New Jersey State Police, and they touted this as the pinnacle of all of their achievements in the 100 years, was the arrest and the trial and execution of Hauptmann, even though the governor, who was Governor Hoffman, who had just come into office after when the trial was ending, did his own examination and had his own detectives, and he came to the conclusion that they might have executed the wrong guy. He wrote a series of articles about that. So there are a lot of questions for all that time, and yet they've doubled down on the New Jersey State Police on the official story that they have, that the case was solved and over. My own view is that there's still a feeling at this point of a potential embarrassment to their office, because several of the witnesses against Hauptmann were police, members of the police department. They it looks like they committed perjury, some of them. And it's maybe giving them a black eye for doubling down on it all this time. But I think they should do it. And I would hope that the current, head of that office would change his mind. But that's not where they are now. I just saw someone from that office last week at a conference, and the assumption is that unless a court orders them to, they're not going to do the testing.
You've had an illustrious career. We have about 20 seconds left here. What's next on your plate?
Well, I'm still working on the posthumous pardon, hopefully, of Hauptmann. But the next on my plate, I'm doing a reenactment on April 16 at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, of the trial where I put in a new character. And the new character is a modern lawyer cross-examining the state witnesses with evidence that was not made public for decades afterward, which shows major inconsistencies in their statement. And I've done it three times already, and every audience wants to see the case reopened.
Well, if you make enough noise, maybe it's going to happen. Thank you so much for joining us. This has really been interesting. I got a lot of interesting texts there. They're actually saying this looks like a science fiction book that someone wrote, and how can you even come up with this? Suspect number one, The Man Who Got Away by Judge Lise Pearlman. She's got other books available on Amazon that I'm going to get to, and maybe we'll do another lengthy interview on one of those. Thank you so much again for your time, and take care.